We are recording in public session.
Great. The time is 9:02 on March 24th, 2021, and I am convening this meeting of the Corporate Governance Committee of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association as a video and audio conference only in compliance with the state and local requirements implemented in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, Governor Abbott's suspension of certain Open Meeting Act requirements due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on March 15, 2021, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all four members of the committee have been confirmed to be present by video or audio. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shebby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association Employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance are John Alexander, John Peters, Bran Wiwi, Patty Otto, and James Kennedy. Have you chance to join?
I'm here, thank you.
And James Kennedy. Topping, I believe that's it for the intro. Is that correct?
So, yes.
Okay, fantastic. So, Bart, do you want me to run through the agenda? I think first item is on a consent item in terms of adoption of the minutes of the December 16, 2020 meeting. I'm assuming everyone's had an opportunity to review those minutes. Any comments, questions, concerns?
Move for hearing, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Hearing no comments. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. We've adopted the minutes of the December 16th meeting. On to agenda item two, consideration and possible action regarding the review of the association's corporate governance policies, practices, and documentation. Bart, do you want to walk us through this information?
Yes, I'll make an attempt at this. I tried to organize the material that the committee reviewed in its December 16th meeting into four categories. And these categories are somewhat structured as the areas of corporate governance best practice were presented in the October 2nd, 2020 letter from James Person, General Counsel of the Texas Department of Insurance. So as you will see on the screen here, I have a bulleted list of some of the items the committee discussed on December 16th. And then the rest of the materials, I walk through it. There are four areas that we're going to be reviewing. Training of directors, area two, the representation of the association by two counsel, direct access to counsel, and then the manner in which the association solicits proposals for contracted services. So within each one of those, we have materials that we've distributed and shared. Some are in here. I have some additional materials and comments that I've gathered that I'll be putting on screen as we're moving along. But I believe we'll begin here with the two components in the training of directors. And I've mentioned here some suggestions that came from the committee for the initial orientation training of directors and then the ongoing training of directors. So Chair Kennedy, if we could start, I believe it might be best to talk about that initial orientation training of directors and the three suggested revisions that the committee was going to discuss further in this meeting.
That sounds good, Bart. So I'm hoping everyone is on item 2.1. You'll see under area one, training of directors, those suggestions with respect to item one, initial orientation. Three suggestions there from association staff. A section could be added to the training that includes materials from board counsel. Information could be added to clarify the role of board counsel and general counsel. and TDI could be asked to review the portion of the orientation material regarding the role of the commissioner and TDI in supervision of the association. Bart, should we just open the floor for discussion, or do you have anything further with respect to those topics?
Well, before we discuss it, I would like to share, I did approach both Shelby and Jackie as board counsel and general counsel and asked them to provide me with some information on those items discussed here. First, the fiduciary duties of a director of the association, and then the roles of each of board counsel and general counsel. If I could, I have revised the orientation slide deck that is in the material to incorporate a few new slides, and I'll put those on screen if you don't mind. Give me just a moment to switch. Okay, hopefully everyone.
We see the slide deck.
I'm having to switch it real quick. Okay, can you see it now?
Yes.
All right, let me back up. Here we go.
Not moving though, or at least mine seems to be frozen. What page are you on?
Oh, here we go.
Okay.
Now you got it. There are three slides regarding the fiduciary duties of the board, and these were provided by board counsel Betts. And Shelby, I think it'd be best to let me hand this to you if you wanted to describe this material, and I'll run through the slides as you're ready.
Sure. excuse me. Well, there's a lot of text in these slides because I wasn't exactly sure the format we needed, but basically I have identified three fiduciary duties, and I think it's good to start out by saying CLEGA's Act itself, the Governing Act, does not specify any specific fiduciary duties applicable to the board. Find in the Act, however, are some provisions about conflicts of interest, which is certainly related to one of your common law fiduciary duties of loyalty. And you also find in the Guarantee Act references, there's a certain level of conduct that a director must meet if you want to avail yourself of the immunity that's provided to directors in the Governing Act. So these duties that I'm about to briefly describe are not specified in the Act itself, but I think if it came to any litigation, a court would impose these duties on you simply because you are a nonprofit organization. And I think a court would likely analogize the association to a Texas nonprofit corporation, and a Texas nonprofit corporation does have these duties. I think that's especially the case because you are a body that oversees the collection and spending of other people's money. You are the ones who make the assessments and spend the assessments. So I think a court would very likely impose these duties. So just basically, what is a fiduciary duty? A duty that is your duty to act for the organization's benefit and subordinate your own personal interests to the organization's benefit. Now, as I said, there's three duties, and I think most everybody has heard of the duty of care. That simply requires directors to stay informed and exercise ordinary care and prudence when you're managing the organization. And that normally requires you to act in good faith, with ordinary care, and in a manner that you believe reasonably to be in the best interest of the organization. So what does that mean in practice for board directors? It means you need to read the very well-organized and prepared board materials or board committee materials that BART provides you with. You need to read all of the interim meeting communications BART sends you. And when you attend board meetings, you need to carefully pay attention to everything that's being said so that you can make a good reasoned decision. And if you do all these things, you collect relevant information and do use your reasonable business judgment in making a decision. There's a court-made doctrine called the business judgment rule, which will ordinarily protect you, insulate you from any liability for, say, making what in 2020 hindsight was a decision that didn't turn out perfectly. The next duty is the duty of loyalty, and that's simply that directors have to act for the benefit of the organization, not their own personal benefit. And typically that involves you can't usurp a corporate opportunity. I don't think that comes up a lot in the context of the association. But for example, if BART has been saying, we need to change our lease because our lease agreement is running out and it's a terrible thing. It's so expensive in Austin to rent property, but I found this great new office space that we think is a really good deal. You as the director couldn't, after the meeting, say, my company needs new office space in Austin, so let's get on the phone and grab that space before the association can get it. The corporate opportunities of the association, I don't think that's going to come up so much in our situation. The next one, however, is the most typical, interested transactions. If there's any transaction in which you or your company or your close family members are interested, ordinarily you can't do that unless you disclose it, you comply with the organization's conflict of interest policy, which we have, and board approval, and the board, without your participation, approves the interested transaction. And then the last component is you receive a lot of confidential information as you're in your service to the board, and that has to remain non-public information cannot be disclosed to others. And then the last duty, and I think this is a duty that is on the next slide, people don't talk about a lot. It's certainly not it's not as litigated or talked about in case law, but it's the duty of obedience. It makes directors sound like little kids who have to obey, but really what it's getting at is you have to comply with, be faithful to, and pursue the goals of your organization and not act in a manner that's ultra vires. And for attorneys, that means you can't act in conflict with your organizational documents or your basic corporate governance documents. In the context of a corporation, which we are not, that would be you can't do something that's against what's in your charter. In the context of our organization, the association, you can't do something that's completely at variance with the governing act or with the plan of operation or your bylaws or your basic governance documents. So that's basically the reason I go to board meetings and committee meetings to make certain that is the case. So that is your fiduciary duties in a nutshell. You could spend a lot of time on each one, but if anyone has any questions, happy to answer.
Thank you, Shelby. I'll just say in advance of these considerations before us today, from my perspective, this is the most important. I think what particularly for industry members of the association who may be involved in other associations across the country, we're all well aware that the requirements, the duties, responsibilities of board members in Texas are different, distinct, and more cumbersome than any other state. And so as a result, I think it's very important to highlight those responsibilities. Folks appreciate walking into the position, what their responsibilities and duties are with respect to the Texas Association and how they may differentiate in terms of personal financial disclosure obligations and the like from other associations, as well as for our public sector members being able to appreciate perhaps nuances in participating in this board that don't exist in other boards in their professional life. So I think this is all very good information and would highly recommend we include it in the board packet, but I'm interested in others' comments.
I agree. This was a helpful overview, Shelby. I hadn't even thought about these things in a long time. I think this would be good to have in a board packet training. So it's good.
This is Jim. I would agree. It's a good idea to include it in the packet. Just curious, when we do orientation, I don't remember, Shelby, if you were there during my orientation. That was quite a long time ago. Bart, I'm assuming you can read through this materials for folks, but I don't know that you could do it the same justice that Shelby could, for instance.
No, nor should I. I should not be. And I was going to add this after we went through the slides, but in addition to these three slides on the fiduciary duties of the board, we also have the role of counsel and both counsel and their contact information. I'll show that in just a moment. But my intent in showing you this is this would be included in the slide deck, but my recommendation is that orientation be conducted with both board counsel and general counsel in attendance. And on fiduciary duties, Shelby should present that and then take questions, any questions that may arise, and have counsel directly respond to those. I should not be. That should be counsel responding. So that's the way I recommend this material be utilized in the orientation. But I'd also recommend that it annually be reviewed with the full board and be presented by counsel. I think those reminders are always a good practice. So does that answer your question, Jim?
Yeah, it does. And I think I agree in all respects, Bart. Thank you.
I'd like to ask Mr. Huckabee if he had any thoughts on this material. Jim, you're on. James, you're still muted.
Thank you. Okay, great job. And in addition to that, I think it would be helpful. I've been on a couple boards before that had a board portal to where when you go to the Texas Life and Health website, for example, there would be a special portal that you can have this type of information. And Bart, I looked through the other, roles of the association, some of that type of information, and even training pieces that we might, have had. If there was a place we can go there and just to pull these documents up as needed individually, because I know I have them somewhere, but I came on the board, I think, in 2013. And I don't have them all together in a safe place, but that was just my only thought. I really like it, but I would suggest if there was a way to have a portal where the only board members can have access and staff members to where we can get and refer the information from time to time.
James, I appreciate the suggestion. At one point we had a page on the website dedicated for board members only. And we didn't fully utilize it. Then we moved using a Dropbox, but Dropbox is not as accessible for everyone. So I think the board portal suggestion is a good idea to not only have materials like this, but also our corporate governance documents, easy reference documents for board members. And if there's any advice or information needs to come from counsel, if you would give me some time to build that and make it look right, if that's going to be one of your recommendations to the board, I'd be glad to start on it.
Hey, Bart, it's Patty. I can't remember what vendor we use for LTC Re.
Yeah.
But that might be a simple, less expensive. I don't know what their fees are, but
no, it's not left. I use that as well because I post materials for the LTCV board of directors on there. It's Board Bucket, and it's not cheap. And oh, it's expensive. I did look at other board meeting vendor materials like that, and they're a little cost prohibitive. I think we could do it easily through our website and a portal. Easier, but let's try that first. Okay. Teg, should I go ahead and show the other slides?
So I would like to go through, if you could address B real quick, and then I want to summarize those two collectively, make sure we have agreement from the committee to move forward on what I consider to be four different things.
Okay. Now, once again, these two slides I'm going to show you were prepared by each council. A little bit of adjustment to make them fit by me, but these are driven by council. So Shelby, if there's anything on this slide you'd like to highlight on your explanation of the duties of board council?
Well, first of all, the more specific duties are in my engagement letter, but this was condensed to be on a slide. I guess I would highlight that I have a limited role. I represent only the board. And classically, let me back up. My role really has changed over time. When I first started acting as board counsel, Bart was not an employee of an association. He was a partner in a partnership of a management services firm that provided services to the Guarantee Association. So there was a third party executive director employee and the association. So there was, initially for probably the first 4 years of my service, a lot of negotiation with a third party. Now Bart is a member of, is an employee. So that role has gone away. But a lot of boards, certainly since Sarbanes-Oxley, have wanted their own counsel to make sure that they are performing all their duties. So in many respects, my service is belt and suspenders because it's not as if Jackie doesn't review a lot of the materials that I review, but it's a mechanism by which the board can feel that their interests, by having board counsel, that their interests are being looked after. So, I mean, I don't want to go through all the bullet points, or I can if that's useful for the committee at this point.
Well, I'll leave it to the committee, but I think your focus we just mentioned, you see this throughout the bullet points. It's you represent the board, and all these are functions in support of the board and to counsel the board. And I thought it was abundantly clear as of pulling together these bullet points. But before we move on to Jackie's list of duties, are there any questions on these?
And I'm assuming the committee members are just seeing this. So if they had a question afterwards, unknown caller, please make sure that you ask me or Bard for any clarification that's necessary, because we can adjust the slides going forward if anyone thinks it's not clear.
Yeah, I was a little concerned at just pulling these together. I guess I finished them yesterday. Bombarding the committee with last minute materials. I will send this out after the meeting and between now and any presentation to the board of directors. If you have comments or questions, you can either send them to me or Shelby or Jackie when we get to her materials. So let me move on then. And these are the duties of general counsel as prepared by Jackie. And Ms. Rickson, anything there you'd like to summarize or highlight?
Well, I think, you know, as Shelby basically mentioned, my duties and my responsibilities are to the organization as a whole, not only to the staff, for example, or not to the exclusion of the board. And so when I am doing any work on behalf of the association, you know, I'm always thinking about, you know, what is the effect on the board, and does this create, you know, potential liability for the board? And so you can see by the list of my duties there, a lot of what I do is more like the day-to-day legal work that the Guarantee Association encounters. And a lot of that has to do with insolvent companies. A lot of it has to do with, governance and policies and practices of the association. And then, other things like basic employment type questions as they come up, and reviewing, negotiating, and being the point person on various legal agreements. And then, accessing other experts as needed to make sure that the association has the proper expertise to discharge its various obligations.
Thank you, Jackie.
And I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have, or provide more explanation if you like.
As you can see, there's a lot more of operational focus in this position. This is really day-to-day operations. But I will mention there is a small amount of overlap between the two council, and my utilization of council as the executive director does overlap. There are times when I ask both Shelby and Jackie to talk with me, because there are issues that affect the association as a whole and the board simultaneously. Plus, their different experiences and perspective as legal counsel, I pull from both of them. They have extensive experience. They have different approaches at times. They're tact. I like to have both counsel's perspective on many issues. So I think these slides highlight their duties, but there are many times when both counsel are involved on issues. And while you're thinking through this, and I will distribute the material later, there is a slide added specifically. So we have the contact information for both Shelby and Jackie. Should a director want to call them, fax them, both their office numbers and cell numbers are provided, and their mailing addresses. So direct contact with counsel is provided to the directors and will be encouraged. So these slides, as I said, I would recommend they be incorporated into the orientation materials of a new director, the involvement of both counsel in presenting that orientation. And then this information should be revisited, and these slides represented annually to the board. And if we do pull together the portal, Mr. Huckabee, this information would be very obvious and available to directors on that portal.
You know, Bart and James, I think it merits mentioning that already on CLEGA's website, a lot of corporate governance documents are available. So more than any other Guarantee Association that I know.
And that is a benefit and a burden. Just to remember when things are being revised, what needs to be updated, more on topping than on me, but it is beneficial. And we do have questions occasionally from member companies and from consumers on some of that material. But our tendency is to be more transparent than most. It's just a proper way to manage the type of entity that the association is.
Mm-hmm.
Bart, I'll just mention, first of all, I think this all these materials are excellent, and I concur from my perspective, these should be included in the board packet and become part of board orientation together with all the individual board duties previously discussed. I'll just highlight from board council perspective, for me, a huge value for Shelby is her management, her assistance with board in terms of annual evaluation, not only of the association staff, but also of the board itself, so that we can determine best practices going forward and modifications based on input. And then from Jackie's perspective as association counsel, what I find most helpful that we don't always see in other associations is her involvement nationally with respect to insolvencies and particularly litigation associated with those insolvencies, being able to not only just report, but participate in those discussions and provide us real-time information is very helpful. Any other thoughts, comments?
You know, I was just going to ask Ted, I think it's helpful that you and Jim both sit on, James, I'm sorry, multiple guarantee associations. So that's an interesting perspective to hear, because I'm just on this one. But just this fact that you're pointing out that Jack has been involved in all the litigation, just, you know, compared, how is ours compared to other guarantee associations in other states in terms of governance and representation by legal counsel?
Right. I will tell you, I'm on four other boards across the country, and none of them have the level of service or attention to detail as do the staff of this association.
And Patty, I will add, I have been contacted. I'm routinely contacted by other guarantee associations to share documents, policies, procedures, practices with them. Recently, I've been fairly bombarded because there have been so many new executive directors hired, and a lot of them are looking at practices and policies that were non-existent in their associations. They're wanting to develop them, and they don't know where to start. So I've been sharing a lot of our documents with them, so you may see the level of corporate governance ratcheted up across the system a little bit more.
Not surprisingly. And I apologize to the group. My neighbors are having some major construction done. So if you hear background noise, I apologize, together with my own four-legged doorbells that continue to go off as they hear that activity. So in summary, from my perspective, based on these items A and B, it sounds like we're talking about possibly four things as a recommendation to the board. One is the additional of new content to the board packet, both board materials and council information. Second is affirmation and expansion of board orientation live meeting. Third is an annual refresher for the total board of these duties and responsibilities and information. And fourth is the possible consideration of a portal that might be available real time to board members on an ongoing basis. Is that correct?
Can I clarify one thing?
Yes, please.
I believe I heard that it's a good suggestion, but I'll make sure I get it right. We're talking about adding this information to the orientation materials and to the annual materials presented to the board. I believe you also said that it would be good to add this information to board packets. So the fiduciary duty statement and the role of counsel, or which components of that are you saying you would like to have
put in
every board material packet?
So it raises a question. Maybe I'm confused, but my assumption is that we would add this information to the board packet in total. And that board packet is then used as hard copy reference material for the in-person oral orientation. And then a summary or condensed version of this might be used and gleaned from the board packet on an annual basis for the board refresher.
That That helps.
When you're saying board packet, Ted, you're talking about the board orientation packet, not every board meeting briefing materials.
That's correct. I'm sorry if I confused the two. That's correct.
And that was the clarification I was looking for. Thank you, Jackie. I didn't know if you wanted this in every board meeting material packet. I'm not saying it's not a good thing, but it does add some volume.
Yeah, no. I'm talking about the board orientation packet, hard copy versus the orientation, which I'm considering an oral presentation. So hard copy there. Now, what might be helpful is to have the full litany of information found in this portal if we're able to arrange for that, so that that's available real time at any point. But in terms of regular board meetings, we would only bring this information on an annual basis in condensed format as a refresher to the board.
And I'm assuming that's a recommendation that is being pondered right now by the committee to make to the board at its meeting.
Yes, I agree with all that. Ted, do we need a motion to make that recommendation to the board then? If so, I'll make that motion.
Okay, so if we were to address these as we go, Bart, then should we take a motion on these four items pertinent to 1A and B of your outline here? If we need a motion, we have one. Do we need a second? Or we need a second?
This is Patty, a second. Oops, sorry, James.
Okay.
So all in favor of including these four suggestions as a recommendation from this committee to the full board, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? None. So unanimously carries forward these four recommendations with respect to those initial items. I think, Bart, that then brings us to 1C.
Yes.
In terms of the discussion of TDI engagement.
And I'd like to share some information. I went back in our archives to look to see what information we had on training being provided by the Department of Insurance. And most recently, I can remember that there have been times when the Department of Insurance would attend. I would do the orientations by phone, and they would attend the conference call and explain the role of the department and their perspective of the association during those orientations. If I could bounce ahead here just a little bit. But in our archives, I found a document. And this is from 2000. It's only 21 years old. This was an orientation packet that the Department of Insurance presented to new board members. And I believe this was distributed with a cover note to the board from Shelby. That is what I found in our materials. And it's interesting. This is the table of contents of the materials that were reviewed by the Department of Insurance. And James, I don't know if this has been updated or changed or revised since 2000. And I don't know if it would be at the starting point, but I have not discussed this with our colleagues at TDI about what they feel should be included in the orientation materials for a new director.
Yeah, Bart, this is something that we used a long time ago. It has not been updated. I'm just looking at the front. I mean, I can tell you without going farther into it that it is way out of date. The outline might not be bad, but the rest of it, you'd probably have to start from scratch.
Yeah, probably would. I looked at this, the role and expectations of the board member, and the first bullet kind of jumped off the page at me that, that might need a little bit of update.
Well, like I said, I think this thing would have to start with a clean slate. Although the outline on the first page, you know, has some topics that I think are probably, you know, worth covering, but that's about it.
Okay.
You know, for example, the conservation program. Well, that program, as it was constituted back then, doesn't exist now. Now it's an entirely different structure. So my question to you would be, or to the board would be, whether they see value in having something along these lines to explain perhaps what TDI does with respect to troubled companies before they end up on the guarantee fund's doorstep, so they can have a better understanding of that process.
James, it's Ted. I'll tell you, I find that information very helpful, particularly, I think, when I first began my involvement in guarantee associations, hearing from you this information is a initial learning experience was critical to appreciating what this association and others do around the country. I struggle with whether we should have a full packet of information as this is displayed from TDI in addition to the orientation packet that we've been discussing that will be delivered. I would, you know, my initial thought was maybe there's a way of combining the two, but now that I'm looking at this and I'm interested in other committee members' thoughts, my thought would be to offer new board members the orientation packet and the orientation and allow them some period of time, maybe a month or two, to digest that and have that followed with, and it doesn't have to be a refreshed version of this lengthy document, but perhaps just a discussion with you or someone from TDI staff to go the next step then and fully appreciate the semantics and the substance of what happens through a liquidation process and the association's involvement. And that could be done through TDI or through association staff or in combination of, but I think the content is an important thing. I know when we had our initial meeting of this group, there was concern that we not have folks drinking out of a fire hose their first days as a board member. And it's a lot to try to digest initially. So I guess my most substantive comment is that this is all good information, but we tier it in a fashion that folks are allowed to absorb rather than leave much on the table because it's too much at one time.
Well, can I volunteer something? I did do some thinking about this. I just have not time and I had the time to circle back to TDI with my thoughts on this. And I had developed these thoughts based on the questions I get from directors when we're going through the orientation or as they are beginning their service with the association. What I hear is, you know, are we involved? Is the Guarantee Association involved in the rehabilitation of companies with troubled companies? And if not, when do we become involved? Where does our authority begin? So a very brief summary of what goes on in the regulatory process to try to rehabilitate a company, how the receiverships are administered in Texas, and the activation point for the Guarantee Association might be helpful. The second set of questions I get regularly are, okay, how does the Guarantee Association interact with the Department of Insurance? What's our relationship there? And I could talk about how we communicate on troubled companies, how we share information, the confidentialities that are in place, how we share information in advance of board meetings, TDI's attendance at board meetings. So we could go through the mechanics of how the Guarantee Association and the TDI interact and where the lines of authority by statute exist. That might be the simplest information in the orientation and not much further than that. As you mentioned, Ted, it's already a lot of water flowing out of that fire hose. So that may be enough to get it started. So that's my suggestion. And I could easily work with TDI on coming up with a one or two slides that would kind of summarize this in a few bullets.
I like that. And you know, I have to remind myself and for the entire group, including TDI, you know, to the extent we're asking staff or TDI or even board member involvement to produce these materials, prepare these materials, present these materials, the reality is we don't have a whole lot of turnover at the board level. And so the engagement with respect to the full litany of materials would be, you know, perhaps once a year from these folks, if that. And so we have the first tier of new board involvement in everything we want to present them to help them benefit and enjoy their board experience. And then secondly, what we're going to do on an ongoing basis to remind and refresh all existing board members. And, but on the first one that requires most of the effort, I'm reminded this may only happen once every year or two. And so, Bart, I like your suggestion. And I think we do ourselves a favor to be to be more comprehensive in the presentation of this, but to do it over time so as to not inundate new board members, knowing that we don't have to do this every month or even every year. It only happens once every so often.
And I'll mention that it's looking at the list of items in this packet. Some of this material is already in our orientation. You know, Open Meetings Act, we give a brief summary of that. So some of this is already there. We do talk about the receivership process and the role of the regulators, the role of the receiver, the role of the guarantee association. So I think we could add some material about the interactions between the guarantee association and TDI and not make that orientation package too voluminous. So I would volunteer to talk with the TDI team and come up with some bullet points that I could share with the committee via email.
I like that suggestion. Other committee members' thoughts?
I'm supportive as well. I think it's a good idea.
Okay, so with respect to 1C, we're going to leave that with Bart having further discussion with TDI and coming back to this committee with some ideas, expanding, incorporating information into these existing items we've just discussed and or perhaps other ways and initiatives to convey this information. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'll take that as a yes. So Bart, I think we've made our way through item one. Now on to item two, ongoing training of directors. Do you want to speak to those three items?
Okay. A lot of this, I believe, is incorporated in some of the information we just discussed on the orientation package on the role of each council. These three suggestions are some items that I heard during the committee meeting, and just on each one of those, both councils should attend all board of director and committee meetings. That's on the list for each of the council in their duties. Then both councils should continue to provide the directors and executive directors with insights, institutional memory, and legal instruction during meetings via email as issues arise. That's also in their list of duties. And I think these two points are just reinforcements of activities that have become routine practices between council and the board. And then last, the full board should discuss the performance qualifications, engagement history, and current engagement proposal for each council when engagements are nearing expiration. When the expirations, and right now these are 3-year engagements, and we did have the engagements just expire at the end of the year, and both council were engaged again in January 2021. The board does discuss, but there is maybe not as robust of a performance qualifications and review of engagement history as of a discussion as what's intended. When the committee brought up this point, I will say, Ted, that the committee did ask that I pull the engagement histories for both Shelby and Jackie. And if I may put those up on screen, here are the histories for both Jackie and Shelby, and a little bit different. Jackie was originally an association employee. And then she was general counsel as part of the management firm, Lachelle Kaufman and Bowles, during that period when the association was administered and operated by the management company. And then she went into private practice. And you can see that the years there are the engagement renewal dates of Jackie's engagements. Shelby's is slightly different. Shelby was actually a director of the association in 1998. And I have the dates there on the screen. Then after leaving her company, and she went to law firm LaBeouf Lim, something in McCray. I can't remember the name now, Shelby. They change so often. But she was
Green and McCray, but it's no more.
She was with LaBeouf at the time she was engaged in September 1998. And then I believe in 2003, you were with Betts Barton, and in six, you were the Betts law firm. So through the different firms, these are the engagement dates that Shelby has been board counsel. So I hope that's the history the committee was looking for.
I'm not sure who brought that inquiry. Those that did have concern or question, does this fulfill your request?
And if you desire any details, we have all these engagement levels. That's where I got the dates from. I went through our files here in the office, and we have all these engagements. So if you have any detailed questions, I can always pull them. But this
Marge, your record retention goes far beyond anything. I can't believe we have 20 years, over 20
there
years.
There are certain operational items, including I have a file on every director that's ever served on the association. And it happens to be in the same drawer where these were. And when I was going through it, I saw some names that I'd forgotten. I said, oh, yeah, I remember. Anyway, there are some records we keep longer that are very important. These just happen to be among that group. But I think it's important to emphasize, and we will talk about this when we get to the contracting, that these are not the type of legal engagements on a specific purpose, meaning like a cause of action or a specific issue. These are more broad, wide-ranging governance, institutional memory involved engagements. And that institutional memory of not only the operations of the association, but past experiences with disputes, precedents, Texas history of receiverships and legislation all come into play here. And I know that those have been raised and discussed in every one of these engagement renewals by the board of a reason why these engagements have continually been renewed.
I guess, Bart, I'll just add, so this history is helpful. For me, the more important aspect with respect to counsel are the existing duties and current activity. It's good to know the background and history. I think it's important for the board to be reminded of the expertise we enjoy with the legacy of tenure of both our counsels. But as you said at the front, from my perspective, these items are already in practice. Maybe it's a point of incorporating or putting to writing current practice and affirming in written presentation what we're doing on an annual basis. Is that fair?
I think so. And I would ask you to kind of hold this information, because in item four or area four here, we talk about contracting. This area two, item three, talking about this discussion of the qualifications, experience, performance, and historical engagements of counsel also carried over into how that process might be changed in the future. So, I would say, Ted, that we just hold that information we've just discussed. And as we move forward into the contracting later, it will be relevant to any proposed change.
That sounds good to me. Any other comments, concerns, questions? Is that, does everyone agree with that?
Yes. Yes.
Sounds good.
Okay. Okay, Bart. I think we have an answer to that one. Do you want to move on to the next section?
Yes. Area three was mentioned, direct access to counsel. And these were three specific items that I heard from the committee's meeting December 16th. A section could be added to the new board member orientation training to clarify the roles of counsel, provide contact information, and clearly state that directors always have direct access to both counsel. We have covered that. And that was incorporated in when we went through area one. The annual training for directors should also contain the counsel information just mentioned. Yes, that was recommended to the committee. And I believe just a moment ago, they said that yes, in the annual training, we restate all this information. And then last, there was a suggestion that the exec director could annually send a communication to all directors to communicate the roles of board counsel and general counsel, provide them with the contact information, and again, provide a reminder and urgent to all directors at any time they should feel free to contact general counsel or board counsel directly. So those are the three things from the prior committee meeting. I will tell you operationally, we have no problems implementing those.
Any questions, thoughts, concerns about those items?
I'd just like to add that I think for the entire time I've ever been board counsel, directors have always called me when they had an issue, and I feel pretty confident that that's the same with Jackie.
That is, I've had over the years, you know, various directors call about particularly, you know, specific insolvencies where they had questions about material that we were discussing at the board meeting and they didn't want to take up the time in the meeting to get more information about, you know, what the legal implications were of something they were asked to decide. You know, just an assortment of things over time. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Jim. I've always felt Shelby and Jackie were fully accessible to me. That being said, I think we've probably talked about most of the items in Area 3 already. I have no objection to moving forward with those.
So Bart, do we need a motion to suggest or offer to the board these three steps? To me, again, it's a more formalization of current practice than anything. But if we're looking to shore up our corporate governance, expand upon the written material, do we need a motion to?
Well, one and two in this area have already been addressed by the action you took in area one.
Yeah.
So they will be addressed. This last one is not part of any training, but that's just annually the exec director should send this email. If you'd like to have a recommendation of the board that I be instructed or directed to do that, that might be the only thing you've got left in this area.
Right. And that's not a heavy list for you, I assume.
No, sir.
So I think that's a good idea as well. Do we want to take a motion on area three, item three, the directive to the executive director? We'll take a motion to recommend that to the board.
This is Patty. I move for the executive director to send an annual notice.
Second?
I'll second.
Great. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, Bart, I think we're on to area four.
Okay. And this one is a little more wide ranging. This touched on the process for soliciting proposals for contracted services. And I separated into two areas. One is contractors for short duration services. That's my terminology, not terminology pulled from any other source. and the engagement of board counsel and general counsel, because I felt those were different engagements. There are two areas where I found some information that I reviewed just to see if this has come up in prior information provided to directors or to the association. And if I could skip ahead one time, I'll go back to the 21-year-old training package from the Department of Insurance. And there's a section in here. We'll skip over the article from James Kennedy, although well-written, James, by the way, holds true today. I'll move into the competitive bidding practices being recommended by TDI. I felt these were, I would almost call them old hand. These are, yes, good procedures. They're almost common sense. A lot of these are, or I would say almost all of them are already in practice by the association. What's not included with your packet, and I'll hold this up in my camera as you can see, I went back to this report, and Shelby might recognize it. This is the state auditor's report of the Texas Life, Accident, Health, and Hospital Service Insurance Guarantee Association's contracting practices provided by the state auditor, Lance Alwyn, in August of 2000. So I read back through this report of the various recommendations and findings on the contracting purpose practices of the association. It should be noted that that report was primarily about the contracting practices between the association and its management company at the time, Lashell Kaufman and Bowles. It did talk about some third-party administrator contracting practices, and then it talked about the oversight of the association by the Texas Department of Insurance. I looked at all of the recommendations in there and say these are either no longer applicable or they've been fully addressed. And I don't feel there's any reason, and that's why I did not include in the board packet, any reason for the board to go back through this audit report. Everything there has been addressed and continues to be addressed. So I looked at the competitive bidding practices in this training material from the Department of Insurance, and it was in your meeting packet. I will tell you everything there is followed. I want to highlight the sample bid requirements might include the following provisions, and there's some dollar amounts and some suggested practices. I think it's important that $25,000 amount is something that we have routinely used within the association, that any engagement that's anticipated to exceed $25,000, we've done an RFP. There have been many engagements less than $25,000 that we've also done an RFP. Okay. Some of the engagements that are only a few thousand dollars, we do not do an RFP, but I will solicit competitive proposals from several firms and then review those and make a recommendation. So there are very few engagements that are not done by gathering competitive proposals from multiple firms. So our practices are very good there. I distributed to the committee December 17th, and also I believe it was Monday of this week, the state of Texas procurement and contract management guide. And I did not put that in the materials, and I'm not gonna put it up on screen because it's only 256 pages long. But I read back through a lot of that material, and I was looking at different areas. Let me pull back the table of contents here. A couple of things I noted. There's an area on proprietary purchases to see if there was anything of a proprietary nature that services are being requested that are only available from a single source. In the contract management guide, it's really talking about goods rather than services, that there is either a software or hardware or a specific product only available from one firm. Services are not mentioned there much, although it could be said that board counsel and general counsel are these proprietary purchases. I think not. Those services are available from other firms. Can they be obtained with the same level of expertise? That could be debated. I did read back through their competitive bidding processes, both formal and informal, that were included in the contract management guide. I went through the procurement method for professional services, consulting services, and legal services. There is very, very little information applicable to the association's practices there. Although this guide is for state of Texas, we are not bound and not subject to these guidelines. I was looking to see if there are any parallels that might be used by the association. The only thing I could find were some of the format of evaluation criteria, evaluation processes, the guides for evaluation. And just so happens, we adopted most of those many years ago. We have an RFP that clearly states what type of services are being sought. We rank the evaluation criteria and weight them in advance, and that's communicated to the proposals. And we don't change that when we're evaluating them. And then we have an evaluation protocol that, I'm thinking specifically in our audit firm selection process, a very formalized process for the committee, the audit committee, to review proposals and then rank. And it's not done as a committee, it's done independently by each member of the committee and then the individual results reviewed by the committee. It is right up to par with what's recommended within this management guide. So with the review of these outside sources, I have very little recommendations on changes to our, excuse me for going back to the page here, to our competitive bidding processes. And that's for the short duration services. I think we've covered that very well. It is very well documented. And I've described in our prior meeting, we use this for engagement of employment counsel on specific compensation studies. We've used it for network penetration testing with IT firms. We have used RFPs for a lot of different services for the association, and it seems to work quite well. For the engagement of board counsel and general counsel, there is a procedural change that I think the committee mentioned in its last meeting that I want to highlight because I do recommend it. And that is, in advance of the expiration of the engagements of both board counsel and general counsel, the committee and or the board, probably the full board of directors, should review the performance, the expertise of each counsel, qualifications, any changes. And through that evaluation, the board could determine whether a request for proposal is warranted and should be conducted. So this evaluation and decision should be done well in advance of the expiration of an engagement. I recommend no shorter than 3 months, probably 4 to 5 months prior to the engagement, end of an engagement. So if the board for some reason were to feel an RFP should be conducted, they have time to go through the process. Currently, the board does a very thorough review of the performance of counsel and a discussion about their skills, expertise, and qualifications, but it's done at the time that an engagement is about to be renewed. I mean, the very day. With an engagement proposal in hand. I do believe that that should be backed up and be done in advance. And I do recall the committee discussing documenting a process like that. And I'll be quiet. I'm just setting the tone there from what I recall from the discussion. And I'm saying I do agree with the discussion, and I'll let you talk about it.
Hey, Boyd, and Mr. Chair, Ms. James, a question for you. Maybe a little awkward with most councils, but instead of their contracts being up the same year, and that's what I understand. It's been consistent. Had there ever been any considerations to where they were, like one would come up one year, the next one would be the following year? I'm just thinking about the time it would require the board to do our due diligence to evaluate their service, whether we put a proposal together, evaluate those proposals. That might take a little bit away from the work if we have to do it for both of them in the same year. And you mentioned 3 months out, 3 or 4 months out, I think it's reasonable. But you're looking at two different very key positions for the association. So that's my, I'm not suggesting shorten. They're both on a 3 year currently. And I'm not suggesting shorten that, but I didn't know if how the other committee members felt, but it certainly would allow the adequate, appropriate amount of time if they're not have to be evaluated in the same year.
This is Ted. I'll react to that. I think that's a good idea. I like the idea of staggering the terms so that we're not focused on both altogether right before renewal on an ongoing basis. If I'm trying to identify any limitations that may pose, I suppose having them synced together enables the board to reconsider each term, the need for each independent counsel versus at some point future aggregating those positions. I would be remiss if I didn't note that that is the case in some other associations. So I don't at all recommend a change here, and I don't anticipate that we would be so inclined anytime in the near term. But one value we have in having them synced is the ability to evaluate both roles and whether we going forward, we are looking to maintain or RFP for one or the other or collectively. On balance, I like your suggestion. I like staggering them and being able to evaluate independent of one another. And if ever we find ourselves in a circumstance going forward where combination or aggregation is a consideration, then we can always look at the term of that individual up for renewal accordingly so that we can adjust. And I'm thinking mainly in terms of at some point future for a succession plan when Shelby or Jackie decide that they're ready to enjoy their lives more fully than the duties and obligations associated with this association. So to answer you, my response is I like your idea. Bart, with respect to the way you've outlined this, I agree that we've had a good process in place for what you call short-term contracts, and we maintain that. With respect to our ongoing relationships, the two board council positions, I'm not in favor of changing anything, but I do think we can do a better job as an organization in terms of governance of documenting the formal renewal process. And by having a more formal review in advance of the end of each individual's terms and discussing whether an RFP might be appropriate, and frankly, at some point, conducting those evaluations so as to compare alternative resources on an ongoing basis, I think is a good governance standard. I think we as a board have already identified that the expertise associated with these individuals is such that it would be hard to replace elsewhere, but good corporate governance would dictate that we at least on a periodic basis undertake that evaluation.
Yeah, this is Jim. I think I'm in favor of all that. I do think it'd be helpful maybe to put a little more structure around our review when the time comes. I personally, at this point, don't think an RFP would be useful just because I think both Shelby and Jackie are very competent and the history is valuable to the board and to me as a board member. But that may not always be the case. So I think it would be good to have an opportunity to discuss at the time, sometime prior to renewal, whether an RFP is useful at that point or not. So I'm in favor of all that. As far as the staggered terms, I guess I'm ambivalent about. I can see pros and cons both ways. So I'm comfortable with whichever way the committee wants to make a recommendation on that point.
Others, Patty, what do you think?
I think I could almost just say ditto to Jim's comments. I mean, I defer to the group. I think it would be fine to stagger their contracts on different years or keep them the same. I mean, if that's what it sounds the right way to do, that'd be great. I think the evaluation's a good idea. Just so that we can document why we don't go forward with an RFP, because with legal services, just the institutional knowledge is so important that there's no replacement. It's not like you go run out every few years just to get a cheaper deal. You know, what you're getting is just long-term representation and the expertise that no one else knew can have, that they just don't have it. So with legal counsel, you know, we're so well represented, but we have to have some kind of process. So I this sounds very reasonable to me. And just, I would say again, I think that Shelby and Jackie both do an excellent job. So,
board, Bart, rather, perhaps based on what you've presented here, we, I think as a committee, can agree that with respect to short-term duration contracts, that we're on track and documenting our current process is a best practice, and we would submit to the board for consideration, affirmation of that. With respect to two board councils, the nuance or change would be that we, as you suggest, evaluate performance in advance with time to further deliberate and, if necessary, on an occasional basis, RFP in advance of a contract renewal. And I would offer that since we don't have a majority opinion one way or another with respect to the staggering, perhaps we suggest that to the board for further discussion at that level and determination as to whether we should stagger or maintain a sinking of the contract renewals of two board council.
Could I add one thought? First, disclosure, I don't think any future procedures will affect me given my desired and anticipated retirement date. With that said, you might consider at some point not conducting an RFP, but an RFQ, a request for qualifications. Again, Bart mentioned, I forget the exact name of the tome, the almost 300-page document on procurement measures. When you look at the section on engaging legal services, again, a lot of this isn't on point and, you know, helpful for the association. But in many instances, when you're engaging counsel, you go out with an RFQ. And when you read that manual, it says you want to make sure you're getting the qualifications that you need. And only after you've selected the person who meet or firm that meets those qualifications do you start engaging in, you know, comparing price or negotiating price. So an alternative to, at some point from time to time, or if you want to, instead of doing an RFP, you could do an RFQ. And if you get multiple, you know, applicants, you would then, who you thought all qualified, you would compare the prices, I assume.
Yeah, Shelby, I think that's a good point. Point well taken. I guess from my perspective, I agree. That's what we should do, and that's a better reference in terms of the terminology. For me, the more substantive aspect was that we don't see as a committee, in terms of our recommendations to the board, a need to undertake such an evaluation, RFQ or otherwise. every renewal period based on the construct of these relationships. But we do owe it to ourselves as a board the obligation to have that discussion. And on occasion, whether it's once every 10 years, 20 years, or 3 years, be prepared to have a process in place for the letting of an RFP.
Okay. And I'm assuming, subject to the board's consideration of your recommendation, that there will be an assignment that I develop some more formalized evaluation documentation. It'll be more robust in advance of the next renewal process. So that'll be fine. Be glad to do it. I did put up on screen that procurement method, legal services from the state of Texas procurement and contract management guide, and it does mention the request for qualifications. Now, that is a specific document that they drive within the state process, but it is something that could be viewed as a source should the board want to move forward any future date and do an RFQ.
I think that's helpful. So I think we have a game plan with respect to these items. Do you need anything from us, Bart?
I don't believe so. I think that the recommendation to develop that practice, and I am sorry, there is one thing. When you make a recommendation to the board in your report and you talk about the short duration contracts, you think that's adequate and you're going to affirm that our current practices are appropriate, and you talk about this deliberative process and built in with some time to deliberate and a more formalized evaluation documentation. The one thing we've not discussed that was kicked around at the last committee meeting was the term of these engagements. Years ago, we adjusted these to 3-year terms, and we've continued to use 3-year terms. There was a suggestion at the committee meeting we should discuss whether that 3-year term period is appropriate or a longer period should be considered.
Thanks for raising that, Bart. I'm particular, before we have comment from committee members, I'm interested to hear from council. Do you have preference or thoughts on the matter?
I don't think I actually do, Ted. You know, I'm thinking about this, you know, obviously more historically. So this is sort of rolled forward on a 3-year basis, and that has been fine. I'm certainly not opposed to the idea of a longer term, and I think if the term were longer, then you know, there might be some changes in the engagement too. For example, that the you know, the rates are able to adjust upward during that time. So I would say that would be the board's choice on that. I'd be fine either way.
Shelby, do you have any thoughts or preferences?
One thing that occurs to me is I think it's a good idea to have the formalized review every time you know, after you decide how regularly you're going to do that to do. But I'd also have, I'm trying to think, maybe instituting a short evaluation form every year for council. You know, I don't want you to wait through, you know, if the board thought I was slacking off or not doing a good job, you can communicate that immediately, not wait 3 years or 5 years. We need to document at some point that if any board member, I mean, in particular, I am board counsel. If board is not satisfied, they need to communicate that. And that's an issue. And it you just should wait. And again, I don't think this will affect me going forward, but I think in these positions, institutional knowledge is really helpful and important. The matters you work on take forever to resolve. Look, I started working on guarantee association matters when Executive Life came insolvent. That estate is still open and there's activity on it. And so it's just very hard to, bring new people in because there's just so much history that's so helpful to be able to react to current activities. So I would try to figure out a mechanism for at least an annual short review. Is there any improvements that either council can make?
That's helpful, Shelby. Go ahead. Somebody had a comment.
Oh, this is Jackie Ted. I think that's a good idea. And it made me realize as Shelby was speaking that, you know, my assumption has always been that if the board were dissatisfied, then they wouldn't wait to the end of the term to let me know. They would let me know right away. But I think it's a good idea to be more formal about that so that, it requires every year the board to actively think about the performance of council.
Right. And I'll just say I agree with both your comments. And from my perspective, we've been doing that, if not documenting it. We undertake an annual evaluation. We have an executive committee discussion of council performance. And to the extent that we see a need for improvement, I would like to think that we've been handling that already. I liken this process to the way I handle staff on my team at my company, which is on an annual basis, everyone is subject to a review. It has nothing to do with your employment. It has to do with recommendations and enhancements. So I agree that we should continue, perhaps expand upon or enhance the annual review process and provide you as much feedback as we do Bart with respect to his position. And if that means we think you're doing a great job, then so be it. But if there's room for improvement or recommendations or thoughts and considerations, we make that available. But then separate and distinct from that, we have the renewal of the employment contract. And I'll just say, I don't have a strong feeling one way or another in terms of term. I think most of the other outside councils I deal with and other associations are closely aligned with a three-year term. Maybe as a best practice, more frequent than less frequent is beneficial not only to the board, but also, as you suggest, Jackie, enabling the opportunity to make sure that compensation is measured against the economy of the day and peer pricing, as it may be, then the shorter term allows for that negotiation. Anybody else have any thoughts? I guess I'm leaning toward two things: a more formal annual process to provide feedback, a performance. And then in terms of contract renewal, we present to the board the idea of staggering, and then separately make a recommendation in terms of tenure. I'm not leaning one way or another, but if I were to cast a vote, I'd say we're good at a three-year term as we stand today, but I'm interested in others' thoughts.
Yes, James. I'm also, I appreciate Shelby's and Jackie's comments, and I am in agreement with the more formalized process. And if the board wishes, I definitely would suggest a staggered term, not shortening the current three-year engagement we just signed, but in the future, a three years and staggered.
This is Jim. I think the annual review, more formalized is also a good idea. I am leery of going beyond 3 years. Some of my other associations, they do it year by year. 5 or 7 years seems like a really long time to me. I don't think I'd be comfortable with that. And as far as the staggered terms, I think it's a good idea to present it to the board. As I mentioned before, I can see pros and cons
both ways, I guess, and don't have a strong feeling one way or another today.
Ted, I think I would just, I agree with James and Jim's comments. Sounds good to me. I think 3 years sounds good on the term. Take the staggered as you do the board. And I like the yearly evaluation suggestion just because that's what we do. Everybody does that in terms of employment, you know, and it gets good feedback. And then it gives you an opportunity to say, hey, you're doing a great job.
So, Ted, I'll give you the feedback from the perspective of implementing this governance practice. Staggering the term, expanding, make a more formalized annual evaluation process, not an issue whatsoever. I would have one request that in the annual evaluation process that I also be able to participate. I have a lot of direct interactions with both council, and I believe I might have some perspective on their performance.
Absolutely. That was my assumption going in, Bart.
Yeah.
I agree as well. Yep.
I agree.
One last comment I would make, at least with respect to my engagement letter, mine is drafted such that I commit to serving during the full term, but it is an at-will engagement that if at any time the board wishes to terminate the relationship, the board can do that. So it's not, so if my annual review or a more frequent review than an annual review was such that you wanted to terminate the engagement, you could. I just want to make that clear.
And mine's the same way as well.
Understood. So Bart, I think we have a committee consensus, a recommendation to the board that we formalize an annual review process, that we consider and propose to the board a consideration of staggering terms or maintaining existing synced terms, and that we propose to the board a continuation of a 3-year term.
Okay. And I believe that's all I had in agenda item 2 that we should discuss. Moving on to item 3, if you're ready, Ted.
Yes, I have that up. Consideration and possible action regarding report of board of directors regarding a response to the October 2nd, 2020 letter from the Texas Department of Insurance on corporate governance and best practices. So I guess my perspective is this, the creation of this committee and our work thus far is all in reaction to that letter. Bart, I'm not sure.
Well, I should explain. The reason I bifurcated this on the agenda, I thought that the approach would be for the committee to look at these governance practices we've discussed and make recommendations to the board on any type of enhancements to the current practices and refinements that they felt were appropriate. And you've done that, and you'll be reporting to the board. But the other component is this letter from the Department of Insurance. What response, if any, would the board or would the committee recommend that the board provide to the Department of Insurance on the actions they've taken? What should be the format of that report? From whom should that report or the letter be provided? I thought the committee might want to discuss this and make a recommendation to the board. Should the board accept your recommendations on these enhancements, how should those be reported to the Department of Insurance?
That's helpful, Bart. And for members of TDI on the call today, so certainly I would recommend to the board that we have a formal reply in response to this solicitation letter or this letter of engagement. Whether that be done part and parcel to their participation in an upcoming board meeting of this group or by formal written letter in response to this, I don't have a strong proclivity, but I'm interested. TDI, would you prefer it in one way or another? Would you like to just hear a presentation made at our next board meeting to you once the board adopts and formalizes its response to your letter? Or would you prefer us to have either board or staff put pen to paper and respond in writing.
Hi, everybody. It's John. I have a couple of thoughts on that. First, I think that it's important the way you've gone about addressing this as a committee, and how it's also covered and been covered in each one of the quarterly board meetings. But you know, I was thinking, since the original letter came from the general counsel, James Person, and came really outside of board meetings, I think a separate, you know, written response directed to general counsel James Person would be a good idea.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, while you're considering this, the committee did ask that I follow up with a couple of entities that are similarly situated to the association on how they have responded, what actions they have taken in response to the letter that General Counsel James Person did provide to their directors. I approached Marvin Kelly of Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association, Bernie Berner with the Texas Title Insurance Guarantee Association, and then Stan Strickland, the new general counsel for the Texas Surplus Lines Stamping Office. Marvin told me that the TP SEGA Board of Directors also formed an ad hoc corporate governance committee to review its board member training program and its RFP program for all contracts. And just a minute, Shelby, if there's anything you'd like to add there on how any actions there have been communicated back to TDI, you can. Bernie and I talk quite often, but he did not respond to my call on this or my email. But Stan Strickland and I had about an hour-long call, and we finally had to quit late one Friday night and said enough is enough. But the Surplus Line Stamping Office took a lot of steps here. They had their executive director and all executive management of that association had been terminated recently. And there was, I won't get into the issues that Stan described to me, but he was brought in as new outside counsel, and they've started from square one and started rebuilding all their corporate governance programs. They have a new executive director in there, and that just started last March. And they actually have a former TDI person, Jeff Hunt, was hired as an independent examiner to kind of work with the stamping office to oversee some of their practices. So a lot of the issues that we saw in the James Person letter were an issue with the stamping's office. And Stan Strickland's told me they are in process of addressing all of them. Recently, they even filed and had a completely new plan of operation approved by the department. And I believe the department is very involved in everything they're doing. I think, Patty, you've had a lot of input with the stamping office. But that I just wanted you to be aware that it appears the approach being taken by the Property and Casualty Guarantee Association is very similar to what you've done and how they've responded. The stamping office, it's been a lot more work, a lot more effort. I think they had more need on some of these corporate governance best practices than this association had. But that's the perspective I gathered from discussing it with these other entities. And Shelby, how the TP SEGA might be responding to TBI, if you could share that.
Well, sure. I'm outside general counsel to that guarantee association. And I think in many ways, we're doing the same thing as the Life Association is doing. And there's a lot of good corporate governance that is practiced, but has not been formalized into documentation. And so that's what the committee is really working on. And the goal is to go through all major policies and to document them and to review current policies to make sure that they're properly updated. So we're following the same approach as the Life Association.
So Bart, with that input and based on the comments made at TDI, and I fully appreciate that having this letter come from the General Counsel's office as opposed to staff we regularly work with on in terms of quarterly board meetings, that maybe a written response would be appropriate. I don't know that it needs to be a compendium of everything that's been discussed, but more a summary of initiatives undertaken and pronouncements made and adopted by the board to show fulfillment and response to the directive. Unless you see it to be a much larger undertaking, Bart, I would think that that would be something the committee would recommend to the board that you and staff undertake and present back to the General Counsel.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I was kind of hoping that'd be the direction you go, because you've gone through a lot of work. I think you should demonstrate that and tell TDI we've really done our job. So staff, we'll assemble a summary of the work performed by the committee and general comments on enhancements that have been done. And we would prepare a draft of that. I think it would be appropriate for the board chair and you as corporate governance chair to both sign. So we'd like to prepare that letter for the both of you to read and edit. And I think that would be the best recommendation to the board to do after this next board meeting.
Yeah, that's exactly my thought on the matter. Interested in any further comment, or do you agree in terms of committee members and folks from TDI? Does that sound good to you?
This is Jim. As a committee member, I agree with that response. I think that's appropriate.
James Huckabee, I'm also in agreement.
Me too. Good suggestion.
Okay, I agree. I believe that would be a recommendation from the committee.
Yes.
To send that letter from board chair and corporate governance committee chair.
Right. So I think added to the list of things we will present to the board is a recommendation that the board approve staff to respond to TDI's letter with a formal reply to the General Counsel's office in the fashion that you've just outlined.
And let me go a little bit into governance here, Jackie and Shelby. Just looking at the notes, as we've gone through these areas, the committee has taken action through the form of resolutions on some of these, and others are just these are the recommendations we're going to make. Should we have resolutions saying the board is recommending, I am very strongly supportive of this, the committee is recommending that the board send a letter in response to James Person, outlining its activities and refinements to its corporate governance practices, and such letters should be signed by board chair and corporate governance committee chair.
I think it's a good idea to be consistent, Bart, and have, you know, resolution for these recommendations.
Agreed.
So on this most recent consideration, as we've just identified, do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion further? Hearing none, all in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, Bart, so it looks like we have checked that action item.
Right. We always include an executive session item should the need arise for any confidential discussion, or you need to have confidential advice, privileged advice provided by counsel. I have not heard the necessity for an executive session, but I'll leave it to the committee if you'd like to hold an executive session.
Committee members?
James, I don't see any matters that need to go to executive session.
This is Jim. I agree.
Okay. So, Bart, I don't believe the committee is recommending an adjournment to executive session. It's unnecessary in this meeting. We may move on to any other matters. and item six, perhaps.
Right. As you will recall from your time on the board, at the end of every meeting, I usually put the schedule of the next meeting date and give you a calendar of activities. This is not a standing committee, it has standing obligations, so there is no calendar. And I was not at the time thinking that there might be the need for an additional committee meeting. I didn't know which way the committee might be going. I would recommend, I have not heard any follow-up necessary by the committee, but we wait to hear how the board responds to your recommendations. And if they have follow-up or something more in-depth in research they request, then we could schedule another meeting. And then depending on that, we'll talk about whether the committee should be continued for any length of time. But right now I see no need to schedule another meeting.
I totally agree. So we don't need to calendar the next meeting, but also we don't need to recommend to the board that this committee be dissolved as of yet. We maintain ourselves at the will of the board and make our presentations at the next board meeting. And based on those recommendations and determinations, we can then identify whether we need to continue and have further meetings or not.
Hey, Ted, I would say one thing. My thought on that is that maybe a committee stay appointed just for ad hoc purposes. I mean, it's just something to think about versus dissolving it. It's just
that's a fair idea. Point. I thought along those lines as well, so I'm glad you raised that. I liken it to our legislative committee that was somewhat ad hoc, but you could perceive a need on an ongoing basis to have such a committee. So, Bart, I'll defer to you, but I do agree that while inactive, we should maintain, and I don't know whether that's maintain an appointed committee that's inactive and then brought back into activity as needed, or whether we just designate this and legislative and others as ad hoc committees that may, from time to time, be convened.
Between now and the board meeting, Ted, I'll communicate with you, but I want to go back and look at the plan of operation and how the ad hoc committees are defined. I think they're described as limited duration, but there's no limit specifically defined. If the committee were to be created and changed to a standing committee, that would require a plan of operation amendment. And I don't see that necessity, but let me go back and review our plan of operation language to make sure there's not any limitations on the duration that an ad hoc committee can stay in existence.
Sounds good to me.
Perfect. So with that, I think we've come to the end of our agenda. I'll just ask if there are any other items or matters the committee wishes to discuss. If not, Bart Topping, should I read the adjournment notice?
Yes, and with the time of the meeting ending.
Okay, so first I'll take a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
A second?
Second.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the time is now 10:50 a.m. on March 24th, 2021, and this meeting of the Corporate Governance Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.